This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Lindsay Clancy and her defense attorney, Kevin Reddington, sat at the defense table in Plymouth Superior Court examining a children's book. It was marked as a courtroom exhibit. The title was Good Moms Have Scary Thoughts. Investigators found it in the kitchen cabinet in the Clancy home alongside discharge paperwork from a clean hospital, handwritten medication list, and a postpartum anxiety workbook with nothing filled in. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts introduced that book as evidence in the murder trial. The defense would tell you it proves she was trying to understand what was happening in her own mind. The prosecution will tell you it proves she knew exactly what she was experiencing and chose not to do enough about it. Because that's, of course, what happens when you get self-help books. You already know all of the answers. You're just getting the book to confirm it, right? That's how that works, isn't it? It amazes me how disingenuous the prosecution of Lindsay Clancy is. We're just basic facts of how life works. Do not apply. Do not apply. When you have a self-help book, it means you already know everything in it. See, jury? Don't ask questions. It's not about women's mental health. It's not about any of these things. Yeah, it's exactly about all of those things. Your DA was dumb enough to try and take this to trial. For what point? I don't know. Other than somebody wants to be elected again, and we're playing election Parcheesi, mousetrap monopoly with other people's lives and other people's tragedies. How nice. How nice. Excuse me while I have no sympathy when somebody gets hit by a bus. The prosecution would tell you it proves she knew exactly what she was experiencing and chose not to do enough about it. Same book, same woman, two completely different versions of what happened inside Lindsay Clancy's head. And by the end of day seven, the jury had a human face to put on both of those versions. But before they got to that moment, they sat through a morning of forensic witnesses. And one of those witnesses, a toxicologist the prosecution called to prove Lindsay Clancy was lucid on January 24th of 23, said something under cross-examination that the cross of the Commonwealth is going to have some trouble walking back. They seem to keep doing this because they're trying to live in a narrative that doesn't exist and bringing people into it saying, play along, follow the rules. And then when they actually express facts and reality, then don't go along with their convoluted version of it. You're making the point for the wrong side. The biggest thing that happened on day seven happened the day before day seven started. Clancy's defense agreed to stipulations on chain of custody for the exercise bans, the DNA, the blood evidence. Reddington told the court they hadn't been contesting the government's case in chief. That matters more than any single piece of testimony in the trial so far. The defense has never argued Lindsay Clancy didn't do it. They've never denied that she used exercise bans to end the lives of her three children, 5-year-old Cora, 3-year-old Dawson, and 8-month-old Callan, inside her home in Duxbury, Massachusetts, on January 24th of 23. They're arguing she wasn't in her own mind when she did it, that she was in the grip of postpartum psychosis so severe that she couldn't be held criminally responsible. The state likes to pretend that that's not a real thing. And that's their argument. That just doesn't exist. It's not a real thing. People don't have that. It doesn't go on. Oh, there's a whole medical community that recognizes this as a real thing. And there's real women who go through it and they suffer from it and they deal with it. And there's treatment sometimes and sometimes there's not. And sometimes it goes horribly wrong because it's hard to really identify because it happens to 1 in 1,000. There's all this information of this existing in the prosecution in the state of Massachusetts. In the state of Massachusetts, it just doesn't exist. So ladies, by the thinking of the state of Massachusetts, that's where you want to have a baby, because in the state of Massachusetts, there is no such thing as postpartum psychosis or postpartum depression or really anything that goes along with it. You just have the baby and you're happy and wonderful and everything's great. You're barefoot and pregnant walking around the house while all the men, just use you, basically. That's the version That's the version of reality the state of Massachusetts likes to pretend somehow exists in this weird, fucked up reality. They're trying to tell a jury of 18 people as they have to prove that the woman who was acting psychotic really wasn't psychotic. Yeah, somebody, the DA had to sit at their desk and go, this seems like a great case. Let's take this one on. Bless your heart, Massachusetts. Bless your heart. That stipulation wiped out dozens of chain of custody witnesses the prosecution would have needed just to authenticate evidence nobody was disputing. So there really was no point to parading all those people. It's a good thing it's not going to happen because it was all a dog and pony show designed to pull on the heartstrings of the jurors of a horrible tragedy that took place. But it was unnecessary because nobody was asking. Nobody was saying, let's prove that she did this. She's already sitting there saying, she did it. We're not arguing that. But the state wants to just keep rehashing the same thing over and over and over until the judge finally said, yeah, no, there's not really a point to any of that. With that being said, that being removed, this could compress the trial originally estimated at 6 to 8 weeks to a lot shorter. Reddington gave the prosecution a procedural concession that brought himself a structural advantage. The defense's witness, the postpartum psychosis experts, the psychiatric evaluations now get to the jury sooner. The prosecution opened day 7 with Ethan Negri, a physician assistant who worked at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He treated Lindsay Clancy's wrist lacerations after she was transported to Boston on the night of their deaths. The prosecution's angle was clear from the first question. ADA Shannon Buckingham asked whether he'd observed any active bleeding when he examined her wrists. He hadn't. He described the lacerations on her neck as superficial. Of course, that word has been doing a lot of heavy lifting for the prosecution across multiple witnesses now. They just keep going. Again, this is like arguing with a child. It really is. We've already established this fact or this point. You just keep going back to it and arguing it. Why are you doing that? Why are you doing that? You keep going on the superficial wounds. Yes, we understand the lacerations on her arms and her body were technically superficial, meaning they didn't kill her. Jumping out the window nearly did, she coded. So yes, you can have parts of your body with superficial wounds, others with damn near deadly wounds on it simultaneously. Two things at once, two thoughts at the same time. I know it's difficult. Massachusetts, DA, prosecution, to understand that, I know, because you like to live in some other land of make-believe. But these things can all work simultaneously, but I understand you're trying to brainwash a jury, so I guess have at it. The theory is really straightforward. The cuts weren't a real attempt to end her life. They were staging, and of course, she's just staging it all, right? It's all a big ruse. The woman's in control was all a big performance, killing everybody, almost killing herself, all a performance, just a big old, you know, dog and pony show. Reddington got his moments on cross. Negri confirmed that Lindsay Clancy was critically ill when he treated her. One laceration on her right wrist measured 3.5 centimeters deep, required 3 stitches. Her left wrist needed 1 additional stitch. On redirect, Negri clarified that the word deep in his medical notes described the direction of the wound, down through skin layers, not a characterization of severity. The prosecution needed that distinction, but the measurement was already in the room. 3.5 centimeters, 3 stitches, and that's just the wrist. The prosecution's superficial strategy has a ceiling, and they're approaching it fast. They can keep lining up every medical provider who looked at Lindsay Clancy's wrists and neck. They can stack no active bleeding from every possible angle, but what they can't do is explain the jump. Lindsay Clancy went out a second-story window of that house. A surgeon who testified days earlier described complex spinal fractures. She's paralyzed from the waist down permanently. She's never going to walk again. The prosecution's asking the jury to believe a woman who broke her own spine was performing for an audience that hasn't arrived yet. Who stages a scene and then shatters their own back? That question is sitting in the courtroom, whether anyone wants to ask it out loud or not. From there, the prosecution ran through forensic witnesses like they were checking boxes. And honestly, that's what most of it really was. Katerina Station,
a former forensic scientist from the DNA unit of the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab, walked the jury through DNA recovered from the exercise bands and the exterior of the house. The results matched each tile to a specific band. No shit. Nobody's arguing any of this, but the state, in their infinite wisdom and lack of actual story to try and tell a jury about, has to keep going back to shit that's not really up for debate. Dawson's DNA was on the yellow band. Chorus was on the black. Callan's was on the blue. Blood on the exterior shingles. Below the bedroom window was Lindsay Clancy's. The DNA mixtures were complicated because every contributor was a first-degree relative. Parents and children sharing so much genetic material that their profiles blur together and the standard interpretive framework starts to buckle. None of it matters. Nobody's debating this. But, of course, the prosecution wants to put it in front of a jury because it sounds really bad. Reddington objected to the testimony as typical DNA gobbledygook. Prosecutor Jennifer Sprague fired back that she objected to his objection and called it ridiculous. Sullivan overruled him, called a sidebar. You don't get that kind of heat in a courtroom unless both sides know the ground is shifting underneath them. State police toxicologist Nicholas Roberts was next. Clancy tested negative for alcohol and THC, positive for benzodiazepines, though, at least four or five different ones in her blood, prescribed legally by her doctors. Reddington asked him straight, "That's a large amount of drugs, isn't it?" Robert says he's seen more. Reddington pushed, "It's still a lot." Robert agreed, "Yes." Then came forensic scientists Hillary Griffiths and Alicia Zimmerman. Griffiths confirmed Clancy tested negative for amphetamines, cocaine, fentanyl, opiates, and cannabinoids. Zimmerman tested samples from the three children. There was no drugs in any of their blood. The children were clean. So we've established what we already knew. Ooh, good job. Then the prosecution called the witness that they'd been building towards, Justin Bauer, a forensic toxicologist from NMS Laboratories. NMS handles roughly half of all postpartum toxicology testing in the United States. According to testimony, Bauer quantified four psychiatric medications in Lindsay Clancy's blood from the night of January 24th, 23. A mood stabilizer, an antidepressant, another antidepressant, and Quantapine, an antipsychotic sold under the name Seroquel, which is also prescribed in low doses for insomnia. Robert testified that three of the four medications and diazepam were all within normal therapeutic ranges. Seroquel was slightly elevated, roughly double what one might expect, but approximately 10 times below the concentration considered toxic. Two of the benzodiazepine, diazepam, and lozepam were actually subtherapeutic, lower than expected for someone taking them as prescribed. But when you start taking a medication, you usually don't start at the higher dose. You start at the lower dose to get your body used to it. That's how basic medication applications work. I know, it's just basic shit. But if you don't know, you don't know. And that's what the prosecution's relying on. People who don't know. And let us misdirect you in 50 different ways to make you think something is what it's not. If we word it this way and don't fill in the blanks and lead you by omission, maybe you'll agree with our fucked up theory over here that she was some evil person who just thought on a Tuesday, you know what? Let's just kill everybody. Why not? You know? Despite begging for help, despite trying to get better, I've never seen a case like this where someone has tried so many ways to get help and have been failed every which way and then gets blamed for it. Bauer gave the prosecution the line that they wanted. Usually people take handfuls of pills when they're trying to harm themselves and take their own life, he testified. This was not consistent with that. He also confirmed that the Narcan paramedics administered to Lindsay Clancy that night would have done absolutely nothing. None of the drugs in her system work on opioid receptors. The Narcan was really medically pointless. Then Reddington stood up. He asked Bauer a simple question. Do the numbers alone tell the full story of what happened to a particular individual? Bauer's answer, correct. They don't tell the entire story. He conceded he'd need the underlying medical facts, not just blood concentrations, to draw conclusions about what those drugs were actually doing inside her body. Prosecution's going to tell you it's witchcraft. It was demons that were, woo! They might as well bring out like an exorcist, a Catholic priest. Father, what do you think was happening there?
Well, my child, it was the demons that were taking over her because she was practicing witchcraft in Massachusetts.
Therapeutic range, that's the phrase the prosecution paid for with this witness. But therapeutic range means the amounts in her blood fell within the window that's supposed to help. That doesn't mean the drugs were helping, though. It doesn't mean the combination of 5 benzodiazepines, an antipsychotic, 2 antidepressants, and a mood stabilizer inside one person was doing what any of those medications were designed to do. Lindsay Clancy was prescribed 13 different psychiatric medications over the course of her treatment, and the prosecution's own expert, the man they put on the stand to establish that she wasn't a pharmaceutical junkie, loading up on drugs like Tic Tacs, trying to prove that she wasn't in a pharmaceutical fog, confirmed under oath that the numbers didn't tell the entire story. So, sorry, your bullshit story doesn't work. The prosecution called Bauer to close a door. He left it open. And the defense hasn't called a single expert witness yet. Then came Elaine Rossi, and the entire temperature of the courtroom seemed to change. Rossi was the Clancy family's nanny. She answered a Facebook ad Lindsay placed in 2022 and started working for the family in September of that year. 3 days a week, mostly mornings, primarily caring for baby Callan while Lindsay prepared to return to her job as a labor and delivery nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital. Rossi described Cora as lovely, Dawson as full of energy and funny. She said Lindsay cut up vegetables and prepared food for the children. She kept Callan on a precise nap and feeding schedule and left detailed care instructions in a kitchen notebook that she and Rossi passed back and forth. Prosecutor Buckingham played a video that Rossi had sent to Lindsay, footage of Callan drinking from a bottle dated September 9th of 2022. She was a wonderful mom, Rossi told the jury. I observed a wonderful mom who loved her kids. She was very concerned with their safety. Buckingham asked the question the prosecution needed on the record. Did you ever have any concerns that the children were not safe? No. Look, someone who actually spent time with Lindsay, more than 17 minutes, pushing a drug that a drug rep said, push more of these. We need to get more of these out. Would you like lunch? We're going to bring in lunch. We're going to bring crab and lobster and all this lovely stuff. And by the way, we need to push more of these drugs, okay? That's how that shit fucking works. 17 minutes, give them the pills and go. Pharmaceutical reps, the drug industry. Now, I'm not saying that's what happened with her providers. I have no idea. But that is how the pharmaceutical industry works. It's basically record reps. I come from the world of radio where record reps would basically bribe and coerce radio stations back in the day to play certain music. They still do, just on a much larger level these days. It's the same thing with the pharmaceutical industry. They go to doctors, they try to convince them, they try to bribe them indirectly, passive aggressively, if you will, with trips, food, sex sometimes. I'm not saying that's what happened here, but look, shit goes down to get certain drugs pushed. And I certainly question anyone that's pumping out 13 different meds to this woman in 3 months. What's going on? I'm not accusing anybody of anything, but if you're that quick and ready to be pushing out specific drugs, that many of them, without any regard for her welfare, her mental health stability when she's coming to you for mental health, and it's just like, take this one, take that one too, and you're not communicating with the other doctor, what the fuck is going on in your office? What is going on that she's able to go like that? I get, you know, sometimes they don't work right away. You may need to adjust here and there. I don't know. I'm not accusing. I'm talking about the industry as a whole and how corrupt and shitty it is and how people should be able to understand why drugs like this get pushed out the way that they do sometimes. It's not right, but it is how it works. Lindsay told Rossi about her postpartum struggles, told her she was having trouble sleeping, told her she was going to stop breastfeeding because she was starting a new medication, but Rossi didn't know about the ER visits later that fall, didn't know about the intrusive thoughts Lindsay had confided to her husband Patrick about, didn't know about how far the spiral had gone. And around Thanksgiving at 22, Patrick and Lindsay informed Rossi they would have to let her go. Both parents would be home to care for the children. Lindsay's return to work date had already been pushed from October to November and then abandoned entirely. Rossi testified that she left on wonderful terms. She stayed in touch afterward. Wish Lindsay Merry Christmas. I love Lindsay, she said. Throughout every word of that testimony, Lindsay Clancy sat at the defense table with her head in her hands, tissue pressed to her eyes. She did not look up. Not when Rossi described the children, not when Rossi called her a wonderful mother, not when Rossi said she loved her, not even after Rossi stepped from the witness stand. The jury watched her sob for the better part of an hour. On redirect, the prosecution asked the question they had been waiting for. Did Lindsay ever mention to Rossi any urges to harm herself? No, she hadn't. The prosecution's read on the answer is clear. A woman who had was open about some of her struggles, but hid the worst of them. Selective, compartmentalized, a woman who could control what she revealed and to whom. Yeah, that's pretty much on par for, you know, someone in a psychotic state. A woman who was, in the prosecution's framing, lucid. The defense doesn't need Elaine Rossi to have known everything. They need a jury to see a woman who existed before January 24th of 23. The one who posted an ad for a nanny, ordered a baby's feeding schedule in careful detail. The one whose former employee told the courtroom full of strangers that she loved her 2.5 years after her last day on the job. The one who kept a book called Good Moms of Scary Thoughts in the kitchen cabinet alongside medication lists and hospital discharge papers because she recognized something was breaking inside her and was trying to understand it. The prosecution called Elaine Rossi to establish that Lindsay Clancy hid the worst of her condition. They got that answer. But they also put a woman on the stand who told this jury under oath that their own witness that Lindsay Clancy loved her kids, that she was a wonderful mother, that she was concerned with their safety. And they did it in front of a jury that watched Lindsay Clancy weep into her own hands for the duration of the testimony. The prosecution got selectivity. The defense got a portrait of a mother before the collapse. The jury got both at the same time. They're going to have to carry both when they deliberate. Court recessed around noon. It resumes. The stipulation is clearing the road. The forensic foundation, DNA, toxicology, physical injuries is largely in place. What's ahead is the ground the defense has been trying to reach since opening statements. Why it happened. The postpartum psychosis experts are coming. The psychiatric evaluations and medical records from providers who are now defendants themselves in separate civil malpractice suits filed by both Lindsay and Patrick Clancy. The prosecution spent 7 days building a case on control, superficial injuries, therapeutic drug levels. A woman who compartmentalized. The defense is about to argue that everything the prosecution just presented as evidence of lucidity is evidence of a system that watched a woman fall apart and did not catch her. And if you have a ounce of understanding of any of this or desire to have one, it ain't hard to see. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue our conversation right there. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.